Just to pick up for a moment where we left off last week, we looked at several places in the writings of Rambam, of Maimonides, in which he addressed the subject of the rationales for mitzvot. Some of it was in the Guide to the Perplexed, and others significantly were in the Mishneh Torah. I say significantly because the fact that Rambam considered them to be part of his halachic work suggests that he thought that they were had greater normative force than if they only appeared in the Guide, which is more philosophical and therefore not necessarily as addressing the same audiences. But what he did say was that people have to exert themselves to the best of their abilities in order to understand the mitzvot. However, he pointed out that if they don't find the rationale for a particular mitzvah to be persuasive, they have to accept it nevertheless, because to assume somehow that they can outthink or outsmart God, meaning that God said we should do something and there's an implicit suggestion that it's rational, and yet they say, I don't find the rationale persuasive, is a bit of hubris. It's tantamount, he says, to saying that somehow I can think on the same level as God. So, of course, the question arises, if it isn't entirely up to our rationale, if we don't wait, if we don't abstain or refrain from observing mitzvot until we are persuaded by their rationales, then what is the alternative? So the alternative, as we see, as he suggests here in the Guide, is that opinions, that is to say, thoughts, do not last unless they are accompanied by actions that strengthen them, make them generally known, and perpetuate them. So Rambam somehow thought that it isn't all intellectual. Some of it is what we would call experiential. And here again, we see that he addresses it in the Mishneh Torah. In fact, it's in the very first part of the Mishneh Torah, Hilchot Deot. Again, Rambam considered a part of Halacha to be right thinking. And here he says, Ketzad yargil adam atzmo b'deot elu ad sheyikav uvo? How shall a person habituate himself to ideas, to thoughts, until they are fixed in him? His answer is, ya'aseh, he should do it, v'yeshneh, and he should do it a second time, v'yeshalesh, and he should do it even a third time, b'ma'asim she'oseh al pi ha'de'ot ha'emtzayiyot, that those deeds that are determined by the famous golden mean should be practiced. People should practice them, they should repeat them, they should repeat them yet a third time. V'yachzor b'hem tamid, and indeed they should repeat them as often as necessary. Ad sheyihyu ma'aseihem kalim alav, until the actions themselves become easy. V'lo yihye v'hem torach alav, until one can observe them or perform them without any effort. And then he says, yikav'u hadeot b'nafsho, that will enable these ideas, these attitudes, to be embedded, as it were, in his soul. So the key to all of this, as you see in the underlined text, is what Rambam calls hergel, habit. And indeed, the subject of habit is one that Rambam thought very highly of. If you just take a moment to look at the text in front of you, it's from Rambam's commentary on the Mishnah. And if you're not making any sense of it, it's okay, because it's actually in Judeo-Arabic. It's just a reminder that many of Rambam's works were not written in Hebrew. In fact, the Mishneh Torah and some of his letters are indeed the only things that he wrote in Hebrew. Most of what Rambam wrote, including the Guide to the Perplexed, and including his commentary on the Mishnah, and including the major parts of his correspondence, were written in Arabic in Hebrew characters. Here is the translation of it. He is explaining a Mishnah that uses the word chinuch in it. The word chinuch in modern Hebrew means education, but in medieval Hebrew it meant something else. And Rambam says that the meaning of chinuch is a particular form of education, and that is education by means of habit formation, habituation. And he says that the word chinuch is used in these matters, that is to say, where it appears in the Mishnah, to refer metaphorically to the beginning of a process, as though a utensil were being accustomed to a particular task. Right? What he has in mind is the phrase, a biblical phrase, either Chanukat HaMizbeach, the initiation or inauguration of the altar in the Mishkan, or Chanukat HaBayit, the initiation or the inauguration of the temple of the Beit HaMikdash. So he points out that in both of these places, as well as in other cases, the verbal root Chet Nun Chaf means it indicates the beginning of a process. The first time that the Mizbeach was used, the first time that the temple was open for business, so to speak, it was being accustomed to a particular task. And therefore, he says, when the same term is used to apply to human beings, right, then it's used as a metaphor by way of comparison to a person who is first learning a particular science or acquiring a particular virtue. And how does the person learn this science? How does the person acquire that virtue? Through repetition. He repeats it until he masters it. Now, the interesting thing is that the identical definition of chinuch was given a century earlier by Rashi in his Torah commentary. In the beginning of Bereshit, it describes how Abraham went to battle against a quartet of Mesopotamian kings in order to secure the release of his nephew Lot, who had been taken captive. And when he did so in the company of his retainers, of his household servants. And the Torah refers to them as chanichav, the same shoresh, chet nun chaf, that Rambam gave us a definition of it previously. And here is what Rashi says. Rashi says, v'hu lishon hatchalat knisat ha'adam o kli la'omanut shehu atid la'amod ba. That the verb chet nun chaf signifies the entry of a person or a utensil into the profession in which it is intended to persevere. So indeed, it's the identical definition that was given by Rambam, and it could very well be that Rashi and Rambam in this respect shared the same original third source. So indeed, in answer to the rhetorical question, how does habit work? Rambam explained in classic Aristotelian fashion, and we'll see later this evening just what Aristotle had to say about the value of habit, namely that through repetition of some sort of positive behavior, right, the behavior becomes automatic, what we would call second nature. And that leads to the positive values that are represented by these actions becoming embedded in his personality. So sometimes, as we saw, as Rambam explained, that the important thing, the essence of a particular mitzvah, was not the action through which it was performed or through which it was observed, but the essence of the mitzvah was more likely the inculcation into the practitioner of the mitzvah of a particular ethic or a particular moral. And that brings us to Sefer HaChinuch, which of course leads us to wonder how the author of the Sefer HaChinuch would have defined the word Chinuch. Would he have defined the word Chinuch more in the modern sense and considered his book to be a book about education in general? Or would he have defined Chinuch more like Rambam and Rashi defined it? That is to say, that he would have considered his book to be a book about how to habituate yourself. That is, how to practice certain things or observe certain behaviors until the point at which they became second nature, and that would enable you to nurture in yourself a particular virtue, a particular moral, a particular ethic, a particular dimension of character. So the Sefer HaChinuch was written in Spain in the late 13th century. We'll see in just a moment that amongst the authorities he cites is Nachmanides, Ramban, who died towards the end of the 13th century. So arguably, this is a bit later than the death of Nachmanides. And until recently, until I'd say maybe the last 10 years or so, it was usually conventionally attributed to a well-known and highly regarded late 13th century Spanish author named Rabbi Aharon Halevi of Barcelona. In the last 10 or 15 years, the opinion of scholarship has changed a bit, and the current conventional thinking is that the author was not Rabbi Aharon Halevi of Barcelona, but it was actually his older brother, Rabbi Pinchas Halevi of Barcelona. So either way, the Halevi family of Barcelona of the late 13th century can rightly lay claim to the Sefer HaChinuch. Here's just a small segment from the author's introduction to the book. And the thing to bear in mind is that the author, in his introduction, is writing specifically, he's addressing his son. The impression that it creates is that his son at this point in time is an adolescent, and that his father is concerned that he should develop good habits, both the habits of practice and performance, as well as what today are called habits of mind. And therefore, his father thought that it would be useful if he wrote something that would help his son on a weekly basis to learn about all of the mitzvot in the Torah. So what we have here for the very first time, at least in our experience, is not just somebody who is writing about mitzvot, but we have somebody who has actually compiled a book that addresses all of the 613 mitzvot, the 248 positive commandments, the 365 prohibitions, in the sequence in which they appear in the Torah. So here you notice the highlighted names. He cites as his authorities Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi, the Rif, who lived in North Africa in the 10th or 11th centuries. And of course, as I mentioned, Rabbi Moshe Bar Maimon, the Rambam, and Rabbi Moshe Bar Nachman, the Ramban. And this, as I said, gives us the impression that the author was either a student of the Ramban or perhaps a student of Ramban's student, since you may recall that Ramban in 1265 was forced to leave Spain, and he traveled to the land of Israel, where he was responsible for reviving the Jewish community in the land of Israel that had been somewhat decimated by the Crusades and by the invasion of the Mongols. And therefore, it could very well be that the author of Sefer HaChinuch was not necessarily directly a student of Maimonides, but was perhaps a student of Nachmanides, but a student of one of his students. And here in the introduction, he gets a little more specific, and he says, there are commandments that are practiced today, and he says, all counted, they are 369, which means essentially that he already winnowed the 613 mitzvot to leave out, to omit those that could not be performed at all in the 13th century. Now, the truth of the matter is, and we've mentioned this on a previous occasion, that there was never ever a time at which any one individual could perform or observe all 613 mitzvot. That's rather obvious, since some of them can be performed only by Kohanim and others can be performed only by Leviim, and there are others that cannot be performed by either Kohanim or Leviim. Therefore, it's clear that there was never an expectation that anyone would be required to keep all 248 of the positive commandments and to observe all 365 of the prohibitions. Then, of course, with the destruction of the temple, all of the mitzvot that pertained to the temple service, largely those that pertained to the sacrificial order, to the korbanot, became null and void. So the first thing that the author of the Sefer Achinuch is alerting us to is that according to his, and arguably according to the reckoning of other medieval authorities, of the 613 mitzvot with which the Torah began, 369 of them were still considered to be valid or in force even after the destruction of the temple. And he says in the second line, from these that are practiced, there are some that a person only be obligated in them by a cause, meaning that if something happens, then you have to respond to it. But if it never happens, then there's no response. For example, the famous mitzvah of dismissing a mother bird before taking the chicks, right? The Torah says, ki yikare kan sipor lefanecha. It's one of the mitzvot that we looked at, right? If you should encounter a bird's nest. So if you encounter the bird's nest, then it becomes incumbent upon you to dismiss the mother before taking the chicks. If you don't encounter a bird's nest, or if you encounter a bird's nest and the mother isn't present, right? Then, of course, different conditions, the cause is absent, and therefore the result is absent as well. In the third line, sometimes the cause will never come to a person all of his days, such that it will come out that he never does that commandment. For example, he says, such as the commandment of giving the wage to a wage worker on its day. Right? Torah says that if you hire somebody by the hour, you have to pay him on a daily basis. So too, he says, from the negative commandments, there are some of them that a person not be obligated without his will and through the cause of his deeds. And with his avoiding that deed, there will not be any sin to him and nothing will be lacking for him. However, he says, if we want to narrow the 369 mitzvot even further down and know how many of them are such that we can all expect to have the occasion, the opportunity, or even the obligation to perform them or to observe them, he says, the commandments that every man of Israel is commanded without his creating a cause for it in the world, meaning that it's incumbent upon you and it will devolve upon you in any case. He says, all counted, 270. And he has a mnemonic for it. The mnemonic is a verse in the book of Shir HaShirim, in which the verse says, Ani yishena, I am asleep, but libi er, my heart is yet awake. The numerical equivalent of the letters Ayin, 70, and Resh, 200, is 248. 270. Of these 270 mitzvot, he tells us 48 are positive commandments and 222 are negative commandments. Here, in the next series of slides, is the full text of the first mitzvah in the Sefer HaChinuch. As I mentioned at the outset, the Sefer HaChinuch arranges the mitzvot in the order in which they appear in the Torah, and therefore he tells us in the very first line, Breshit, by which he means not the book of Breshit, but the parasha, the sidra of Breshit, Yesh ba mitzvat aseh achat. It contains a single mitzvah. It's a positive commandment. And as you see at the line above it, the mitzvah is the one that is known rabbinically as mitzvat pirya v'rivya. Pirya, like the word pri, meaning fruit, to be fruitful. Rivya, like the word rov or harbei, right, to be to multiply, be fruitful and multiply. In other words, as it says in the English, the commandment of procreation. So the first paragraph in the mitzvah introduces the mitzvah itself, and it cites the Torah verse from which the mitzvah is derived. And in this case, the verse is Vayevarech Otam Elohim, that God blessed Adam and his wife. Vayomer Lahem Elohim, and God said to the two of them, Pru Urevu Umilu Et Haaretz. So that God commanded first Adam and Eve, and ultimately all of us are commanded to be fruitful and multiply. That's the opening paragraph. The second paragraph is invariably entitled Mishorashei HaMitzvah. When he uses the word Shoresh, and we already saw this last week in Maimonides, he doesn't mean the root in terms of the origin as much as he means the root in terms of the compelling reason or the rationale. So after telling us what the mitzvah is and what is the verse from which it is derived, he addresses the question of what is the rationale behind the mitzvah. And in this case, just to save a bit of time, you see the highlighted passage, Shakadosh Baruch Hu Chafetz B'Yishuvo, that God wants the world to be settled. Therefore, the purpose behind the mitzvah is that there should be, that the world should be populated. The next paragraph, again, invariably, addresses Dinei HaMitzvah, what we would call the halachic details of the mitzvah. In this case, for example, Matai Chayav Adam La'asok Ba, when is it incumbent upon people to observe this commandment? Kama Banim Yulo V'Yipater, how many children do you need in order to be satisfied that you've fulfilled the mitzvah? And then, either the last or sometimes the next to the last paragraph, begins with the phrase, v'noheget. When is this mitzvah in force? When is it practiced? Some mitzvot are practiced only during a certain amount of time. Some mitzvot are restricted in terms of whether men are obligated in them or women might be obligated as well. In this case, he tells us that the mitzvah of Pirya v'Rivya, noheget b'chol makom, it's incumbent everywhere is in the world. B'chol zman, it's not limited to any particular chronological era. V'chayav adam lishtadel bah, and it is incumbent upon a person to make every effort to fulfill it. And then he concludes by saying, u'mitzvah zo eina mutelet al hanashim, that this mitzvah is incumbent upon men, and it is not incumbent upon women. So again, we see that there's a pattern here, and we'll see this pattern in several of the other mitzvot that we'll look at. But what I'd like to look at now is what is perhaps the best known characteristic of the Sefer HaChinuch, and that appears for the first time in the Sefer HaChinuch, in his presentation of the 16th mitzvah. The 16th mitzvah is in the parasha of Bo, and it is a mitzvah shelo lishbor etzem min ha-pesach. That the Jews in Egypt were given very specific instructions about the Korban Pesach, about the original Pesach sacrifice. They had to select the animal 4 days in advance. They had to smear the blood on the doorposts and on the lintel. It had to be roasted. It couldn't be cooked. They had to eat it all, and nothing could be left over by the morning. And it also specified that they had to be careful not to break the bones. So here's what the Sefer HaChinuch has to say. And again, just out of considerations of time, let's just look at the English translation. Notice again that he is addressing his son. And he says, my son, do not attempt to catch me in my words by asking, right? We all have children who sometimes do that, challenge us, or students who challenge us. And he says, do not attempt to catch me in my words by asking, why did God command us to perform all these things because of the miracle of the Exodus? Wouldn't one recollection prompt our thoughts and prevent us and our descendants from forgetting it? Meaning, if the purpose of the mitzvot that surround the Korban Pesach, or let's take a contemporary analogy, the Seder, are exclusively in order to make sure that we never forget our release from Egyptian bondage, then, you know, wouldn't one or two big mitzvot accomplish the purpose? Why all of these details? This would not be an intelligent challenge, the author says to his son. It would be an immature one. So now he says, my son, if you're perceptive, listen carefully, and I shall give you practical instruction in Torah and mitzvot. So here we get an insight into the philosophy of mitzvot according to the Sefer HaChinuch. And what he says is, and again, I'd like to see the Hebrew here. It's on the fourth line in the Hebrew because it's a recurring phrase. Ki ha'adam nif'al kifi pe'ulotav. A person is influenced, is acted upon by his own actions. Meaning, your personality, your character, if you wish, even your thoughts are influenced by the way you behave. His heart and all his thoughts always follow upon the deeds he performs with them, and this could be for better or worse. So he says, even a person who is thoroughly evil in his heart, all of whose thoughts are perpetually evil, if he stimulates his spirit and places his efforts and involvement at the continual disposal of Torah and mitzvot, meaning if even a thorough no-goodnik were to habituate himself to the performance of mitzvot, even if not for heaven's sake, even if he initially isn't doing it because it's a mitzvah and God commanded it. It's, let's say, because somebody said, if you do it, I'll pay you to do it. The Sefer HaChinuch says he will immediately be inclined towards the good, meaning he is convinced that the performance of good deeds of mitzvot will have a positive effect even on a person whose inclinations are not good. And by the deeds he performs, he will slay the evil intent. And again, he concludes with yet another recurring phrase, acharei ha-pe'ulot nimshachim ha-levavot. Hearts, we've already made the observation that when the Tanakh and the Mishnah and Talmud, and for that matter, even the medievals use the word lev, they don't mean emotions. Rather, they mean thoughts. So, acharei ha-pi'ulot nimshachim ha-levavot means that thoughts are drawn after, they are influenced by actions. And that seems to be drawn, as so far as we can see, from Rambam, who, if you recall the opening slides, commended hergel or habit as a way not just of developing good patterns of behavior, but as a way of influencing thoughts and ethics and morals. And here again is another example. This is mitzvah mem, the 40th mitzvah that appears in the parasha of Yitro. And the mitzvah is shelo livnot avnei mizbeach gazit. The Torah actually says that the ideal form that a mizbeach, that an altar should take, it should be made of earth. If, however, it's to be made of stones, the Torah says, the stones should not be hewn stones. They shouldn't be carved. Why? Ki charbecha heinafta aleha vatechal aleha. Because if you use a metal instrument that whose association ordinarily is with implements of war, then somehow it's not seemly that the mizbeach, which is the place on which sacrifices are offered, and the purpose for which sacrifices are offered is to achieve atonement for sins, it's just simply unseemly that the stones of the mizbeach should have been carved by implements that are associated with war. So that's the Torah prohibition. Says the Sefer HaChinuch, looking at the second paragraph, which you recall is Mishor Shei Mitzvah Zo. What is the root or what is the rationale behind this commandment? That we should fix into our souls from the day that we make the altar that forgiveness of iniquity, atonement, blessing and peace will come through it afterwards. As I said, that's the purpose for behind Korbanot. Hence, to remember this thing, we were commanded not to do anything upon the Mizbeach, with tools that are fit for destruction. And that is those that are made from iron that cuts and is constantly ready to spill blood. What does refraining from hewing stones with metal implements, how does that make me a better person? The answer is, he tells us again, is ki ha'adam nif'al kefi pe'ulotav, that man is acted upon according to his own actions, umachshivotav holechot le'olam acharei ma'asav, and his thoughts are always the consequence of his deeds. Therefore, he says, it is fitting for us to do things that are only symbolic, because the reiteration, the repetition of these symbolic acts is bound to leave an impression on our thoughts, on our behavior, on our character. Likewise here, in Mitzvah 99, Tzaditet, from the Sidra of Tetzaveh, Mitzvat Levishat Bigdei HaKohanim, which is a mitzvah that establishes the principle for us that there are certain special garments, uniforms, that are to be worn for the Kohanim. And it is derivative of the verse that says, Va'asu Bigdei Kodesh La'aron Achicha Ulevanav, that Moses was commanded to see to the manufacture of uniforms for the Kohanim. Why do the Kohanim have to wear uniforms? Mishor Shei HaMitzvah, again, what is the root or the rationale behind this commandment? Once again, HaYesod HaKavu Alanu, what he has already determined to be an important principle, namely, Ki HaAdam Nif'al Lefi Pe'ulotav V'Achareihem Machshivotav V'Kavanotav, that a person is impacted by his own actions, and his thoughts and his intentions are thereby influenced by his behavior. Therefore, he continues and he says that the Kohen, as the agent for our atonement, must attach all of his thoughts and intentions to the divine service. Therefore, it is fit that when he performs the divine service, when he brings the korbanot, he should be wearing special clothes for it, so that when he stares at any place of his body, he will immediately remember before whom he is serving. And in case we still think, but it's still odd, what purpose does a uniform serve? He actually reminds us that to an extent, there are certain items of apparel that we all wear as uniforms one way or another. The example he gives here is tefillin, or tzitzit, or it could be simply dressing in a modest fashion, in a proper fashion. All of these things, he says, are acts that we perform, and that when we do them habitually, they have an impact on our thinking. Yet another example of it, and I'm going to skip it because it's just, I think just a little too much repetition. And I'll go to something else. The idea of habit formation, we saw it in Rambam. Okay. We see it in the Sefer Achinuch. And it's curious that it's not uniquely Jewish. Here we have a reasonably contemporary Muslim religious philosopher, Al-Ghazali, who writes, the way to the purification of the soul is to become accustomed, habituated to actions that emanate from the perfect souls until they become habitual by virtue of their repetition, with increasing frequency, creating a disposition embedded in the soul. These activities are transformed by habit into nature, what we would call second nature, and the same positive traits that were initially difficult for us to perform, after we practice them, they now become simplified. And he goes on and he describes the relationship between the soul, that is to say, the mind, our character, right? Between the soul and the body as a circle. By means of the enforced physical activities, right, as a result of proper behavior, the soul obtains a trait, a virtuous trait. This trait then influences the body and determines a subsequent physical activity, which now has become habituated after first having performed it unnaturally. Bit highfalutin, a bit convoluted, but what can I do? That's what he wrote. But essentially, this is exactly what the Sefer HaChinuch said. Acharei ha-pe'ulot nimshachim ha-livavot. And indeed, it's not original either to the Sefer HaChinuch or to Rambam, or for that matter, even to Al-Ghazali. It goes back to Aristotle. Writing about habit in his book on ethics, Aristotle wrote that excellence or virtue being of two kinds, intellectual and moral. Intellectual excellence owes its birth and its growth to teaching, for which reason it requires experience and time, while moral excellence comes about as a result of habit. Indeed, he says, it makes no small difference then whether we form habits of one kind or another from our very youth. It makes, he says, a very great difference. It makes all the difference. The Sefer HaChinuch, of course, is not exclusively devoted to the idea that one is impacted by one's own behavior. But there are other things in the Sefer HaChinuch that, again, we've seen similar things, not only in Rambam, but earlier than that in Sa'adya Gaon as well. For example, in discussing the mitzvah dinei knasot, the law that empowers a court to impose civil fines on people. Shoresh mitzvah zo, again, what's the rationale behind this mitzvah? And it says in this case, u'bichlal, And it's not just this individual mitzvah, but he says, Kol ma sheba b'Torah b'inyan hadin, all civil law in the Torah, says the author, Eini tzarich liyagea achar ta'amo shel davar. He says it needs no exertion on his part to explain it. Why? Ki davar muskalhu. You remember that Sa'adya divided mitzvot into two categories. One, which are things that we know only as the result of revelation. He called them shimiyot. But the other category were things that reason alone is sufficient to compel them. He called them sichliyot. So here too, the Sefer HaChinuch talks about civil law as being davar muskal, something that is essentially self-explanatory. And as he explains, if there were no law, people could not be civilized, nor could they maintain a society. Therefore, he says, it's impossible to live without laws. Another example of where a performance of a particular mitzvah is meant not just to accomplish that immediate purpose, but something larger than itself, is a mitzvah from somewhat later in the Sefer HaChinuch, right? Mitzvah Tav Pei Bet 482, which says that when an indentured Hebrew servant goes free at the end of 6 years of service, it is incumbent upon his master, or the one who ceased to be his master, l'ha'anik lo b'tzeito l'chofshi, to give him a parting gift when he secures his freedom. Namely, he says, to give from what we have to the Hebrew slave at the time that he leaves from under our hand and goes free, and that we should not send him out empty-handed. Right? And again, the Torah verse, ha'anek ta'aniklo, indeed you should endow him, mitzonacha, give him sheep, gornacha, give him grain, mi'ikvecha, give him wine, asher berachacha, Hashem Elohecha, whatever it is that God blessed you with, titenlo, you should give it to him as kind of like a severance package. What's the reasoning behind this? He says, in order that we should acquire for our souls virtuous, dear, and beautiful traits. It isn't just to make up for the fact that this person for a maximum of 6 years has been essentially an indentured servant. It's not that he didn't earn a wage for 6 years, therefore let's give him a little pocket money now so that when he goes free, you know, he can at least have bus fare home, right? It isn't only for his benefit. It's for the benefit of the person giving him the gift as well. And he says that, again, good God wants to do good for his people, and it is our glory and our splendor that we should have mercy upon the one who served us, and that we should give him from something that is ours, besides that we have stipulated with him to give him his wage. Why? He says, because davar muskalhu, once again, it's self-explanatory, it's rational. Ein tzorech la'arich bo. There's no need to discuss this at any length. And finally, going back to the beginning, the third mitzvah in the Torah, way back in Sefer Bereishit, is that as a result of the dislocation of Yaakov, of the patriarch Jacob's thigh by the person or angel with whom he wrestled, the Torah says, Al kein lo yochalu v'nei Yisrael et gid hanasheh, that the descendants of Yaakov Avinu took it upon themselves not to eat the sciatic nerve. Okay. So, again, he cites the Torah verse that I just quoted. Okay. But then he adds something, and he says, the fourth line of the English translation, this phrase, Al kein lo yochlu, therefore they shall not eat, is not to be taken as part of the story. He says, it's not just that because this happened to our forefather, we, his descendants, refrain from eating the sciatic nerve. Which makes a lot of sense, stop to think about it, because the sciatic nerve was not dislocated in an animal, it was dislocated in a human being. So to say that because a human being's sciatic nerve was dislocated, we shouldn't eat the sciatic nerve, it doesn't really match. Rather, he says, Azharat Hashem yitbarech shelo yochluhu. God, almost independently, not that there's no connection between the prohibition and the story, but it's not that the prohibition is a derivative of the story. Rather, as a consequence of the story, God prohibited the consumption of the sciatic nerve. Why? And look at this. It's a rather remarkable explanation. He says, the rationale behind this commandment is to serve as a hint to Israel that though they will suffer many troubles in the exile by the hand of the nations and by the hand of Esav, right? Because according to the rabbinic interpretation, the angel with whom Jacob wrestled was the representative of Esav, and the biblical Esav was transformed in Talmudic and Midrashic literature into the prototype of Christianity. Okay. Therefore, Jacob being injured by the angel of Esav is the equivalent to Christians causing Jews, persecuting Jews. Okay. So, again, though Israel will suffer, they should trust that they will not perish, but rather that their descendants will stand firm forever and their Redeemer will come and redeem them from their oppressor. And in continually remembering this idea through the commandment that serves as a reminder, they will stand firm in their faith and righteousness forever. And this hint stems from the fact that an angel who fought with our father Yaakov, who according to tradition, as I mentioned, was the guardian angel of Esav, wished to eliminate Yaakov from the world, but he could not get the better of him. Net, he was able to anguish him, anguish the sense of harm him in injuring his thigh. Likewise, Esav's descendants, and again, that's the prototype of Christianity, right? Anguishes, causes pain to the descendants of Yaakov. But in the end, he maintains the latter, Yaakov, will be saved from them, as we find with respect to our forefather. And he goes back to the verse which concludes the episode of the wrestling match. It says there, Vayizrach lo hashemesh, that the sun shone for Yaakov. And sunshine is not just an image of redemption, an image of freedom, but it's also a metaphor for a release from pain and suffering. So here, this is actually neither the psychological explanation of a person is influenced by his actions. It isn't the idea that it's completely rational and that it's necessary for the preservation of society, but it's somewhat more, I don't know what to call it, really Kabbalistic. There are clear Kabbalistic inclinations here, and that's not at all strange given that the Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism, actually originated in Spain in the end of the 13th century. So this is part of the milieu in which the author of the Sefer HaChinuch is living. Then, of course, as we saw, he goes into the details, and I really have no interest in the details of who is obligated in the prohibition against eating the sciatic nerve, etc., etc., but that is just the format that he observes. Okay, a word about next week's concluding class before I look at the chat. Next week, we're going to take a step back, as it were, to Saadia Gaon. Saadia Gaon wrote a Sefer HaMitzvot. He wrote a book in which he describes the positive commandments, the prohibitions, okay? But he also was a pietan. That is to say, he wrote liturgical poetry. And one of his piyutim is in a genre that is known as azharot. Lahazhir, azhara, even in modern Hebrew, it means a warning. Okay, but the term azharot, as the title of a genre of liturgical poetry, means specific warnings. Warnings in the sense, the 365 prohibitions and the 248 positive commandments. So a piyut that belongs to the genre of azharot is one that addresses the subject of mitzvot. And there were several paitanim in the Middle Ages who wrote azharot. I think I even mentioned previously, the one that is the liturgical favorite of largely non-Ashkenazi Jews today, the azharot of Rabbi Shmuel ibn Gabirol. Okay, but what we're going to look at are the azharot of Saadia. The key to understanding the azharot of Saadia is that in this liturgical poem, Saadia divides all of the 613 mitzvot of the Torah into 10 groups. That should give it away, right? What are there 10 of? Asara mi yodea, asara ni yodea, asara dibraya, right? The 10 commandments. Basically, Saadia Gaon, not the first to do so. We saw that Philo already mentioned this. Saadia Gaon maintained that the so-called 10 commandments are not 10 narrow, specific do's or don'ts, but rather they are kind of like categories, and that all of the 613 mitzvot of the Torah can be fit into one or another of those categories. So what we're going to do next week largely is an exercise in Tameh HaMitzvot. We're going to look at not the 10 mitzvot that are in the Aseret HaDibrot. We'll look at some of the 603 mitzvot that aren't in the Aseret HaDibrot, and we're going to speculate on to which of the categories represented by the Aseret HaDibrot do these mitzvot belong. For example, there's clearly a mitzvah to keep Shabbat, right? There is in the Ten Commandments, right? One of the commandments is to keep Shabbat. There is nothing in the Ten Commandments addresses Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot, Rosh Hashanah, Yom HaKippurim. So the question is, where, not just me, we know where Saadia Gaon placed those mitzvot, but before we see what Saadia Gaon is, we're going to speculate on our own. Okay? You might say, well, it's obvious. I mean, Pesach and Shavuot and Rosh Hashanah, just like Shabbat. Therefore, they must belong to that category. Okay, we'll see. But let me give you something that's not so clear. How about kashrut? None of the Ten Commandments addresses kashrut. So, if you had to place kashrut as a kind of like a subheading under one of the Ten Commandments, which one would you put it under? Now, of course, there could be as many answers as we can come up with rationales for the mitzvot of kashrut. So we'll talk about what are the possible rationales for the mitzvah of kashrut, and then based upon those rationales, we'll see into which of the 10 categories we might assign it. So that's what we're going to do next week. Have a look now at the chat. Link to the sources, that's here. Okay. I'm sorry, 20 kids, 30, oh, students, okay. Sorry. How does Hadam Nif'al Kefi Ma'asav relate to the statement Sof Ma'aseh B'machashava Tchila? It doesn't. That's just somebody else's. They're not mutually exclusive of each other. One is saying that you can improve yourself by acting in a proper fashion, because your behavior will make those activities more second nature, and therefore they will become embedded in your soul. And the next time you do them, it'll be easier for you to do and more meaningful for you to do it. And the other just simply says that it's probably best to have a plan before you go ahead and do something. So I don't think they're not at all contradictory.
There is also a challenge to the statement of the definition of Ergel, because Al taseh tfilatcha Ergel, or Al taseh et ha-mitzvah ke-Ergel, you have to be in the presence of doing it and not as a habit.
I don't, you just said something as though it were a pasuk. There is no such pasuk. If there is an opinion that says that Hergel is bad, so it disagrees with Rambam, it disagrees with the Sefer HaChinuch. But there is no such pasuk. The one about tefillah says ha'oseh tefillato tefillat keva ein tefillato tachanunim.
Right.
That seems to suggest that if prayer is purely rote, then it lacks a certain emotional quality. Okay, but that doesn't mean that if you want to pray properly, the first thing to do is to make sure that you pray often as you need to pray, and that you recite the words. And then the Sefer HaChinuch says that the more frequently that you pray, the easier it will become for you to have the right kavanah in tefillah. But I'm also not acquainted at all with anybody. After we say the Birchot HaShachar in the morning, the concluding bracha of Birchot HaShachar is Shetargileinu b'Toratecha. So I'm sure that two Jews, three opinions. I mean, somebody said 20, children, 30 students. Yeah. So two Jews, three opinions. So I'm sure that somebody out there must disagree with Rambam and the Sefer HaChinuch and say afui on Hergel. But I'm not really familiar with somebody who actually had the came out and said it. If you've got a source for it, I'd be glad to take it into consideration. Okay. Maxine, it's yours.
Thank you so much for your share. And I'm also looking forward to next week's, and looking forward to seeing everyone there. I'm guessing there's going to be some Rav Hirsch, or maybe. He has some interesting stuff on Reasons for Kashrut. Anyway, so I guess tomorrow we have the Parsha Shir as usual. Also kind of relating to what we'll be looking at next week. Dr. Benny Gesundheit is going to be teaching tomorrow at, I can't remember if that's 11 or 1. Tomorrow, Dr. Gesundheit is going to be teaching on the differences between the Aseret HaDibrot in Shmot and Devarim. Then Friday, of course, Rabbi Kalman is teaching his Shir on Tefillah. And so I'm looking forward to seeing you either tomorrow, Friday, or next week. Thank you so much. Have a good night.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Have a good night. Thank you.
Good night.